Yes, I was born and raised here, Vermilion. Went to school here, graduated from Vermilion High School in 1938. Of course, the war was in 1941, right? A lot of my friends went. The Women's Army Auxiliary Corps was formed in May of 1942. And they sent people out to call, what do you call them? Recruit. And I read about it and I went and joined in February in 43. I was a high-speed radio operator at Vint Hill Farm Station, Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C. And I had a citation from the War Department Intelligence Division.
Okay. Now, as far as high-speed radio operator, what all did that
I
entail?
copied code, Morse code. I copied Morse code. We had two radio sets, one above the other. And what we couldn't get on one, we put on a dictaphone. Then we had to go to the translation room and copy it.
Now, were these codes or messages that were coming from the front, or were
Yes,
these?
all over. We copied code from all over the world and the United States and the ships at sea.
What kind of training did you have to go through to
I went through
order to?
Midland Radio and Television Schools in Kansas City. I graduated from there. And also, I was sent to Camp Crowder, Missouri for additional training for 30 days in teletype machines and copying code from going across the letter code and additional code training so that I could get up to, well, I was up to the speed of 35 words a minute when I left the school. I was a second woman to go to work at the monitoring station.
Were there certain restrictions that you had to go through? Like, all the common phrase now is, if I tell you this, I have to kill you, for example. Were there some classified or top secret things that you personally had to
No,
handle?
no, 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 not till I was surveyed someplace else. I have no, our code was code. What we copied that was what was plain language would be notes from newspapers or something coming in, or and we ignored them, but we did sit on different well, the different codes all coming in at once. First, you would copy one sound, then you would go back and get on the tape and get another sound from the prisoners of war. And we worked hard on those. I can remember sitting there all night just trying to figure out which code was which and what it was code. I had to go to the code room.
Now, in this code room, what would take place?
I don't know. I was never there.
Okay.
That's a separate group.
So you would take the message, you'd take it down as best you could, and then give it to the code room, and it was their problem from
Yes,
there.
right. And only one I really had trouble with was it wasn't Morse code as code. Ours was five letter groups, spaced five letter groups on a piece of paper. And when it came in and just kept going and it looked funny, you just raised your hand. I did, and my sergeant came and got the paper and ran it to the code room. I believe, but I can't prove, that I was the first one to copy Japanese code on the Atlantic side.
Wow. What was that like when you realized it?
What was it? Just weird, weird. And I had turned the whole thing or the record around thinking I was copying wrong. And then I went back to the original and I was all the same. So that's when I raised my hand and the sergeant came running and I got that's the paper. I didn't have anything to do with translating anything. And we did copy plain language from the newspapers, but we were taught never to believe anything you read in a newspaper on half of what you saw.
Okay. When you got this intelligence certificate, what kind of things were involved in getting that?
No, I don't know. It just came in the mail. I couldn't believe it.
Okay. And she's holding up one as Fern L. Marcotte acknowledges with appreciation, loyalty, and devotion to duty, serving with the Military Intelligence Division. Okay. So you did that for about
Oh,
13 months,
yeah.
give or take?
As soon as I got out of school, quit training, I went right down to Vint Hill Farms. They, from, what is the name of that? Well, Camp Crowder, from Camp Crowder, Missouri. There were 200 women to 200,000 men. And from there, when we went to school, we had posted armed guard around our barracks after the first night. And they split us. 100 went to Flint Hill Farms in Virginia, and the other ones went to California someplace. So I don't know where they went, and I never kept in touch with any of them. I left Vermilion by myself with another lady I never heard of again. She went and cooked some baker school, I think. And I was set right out of basic training to radio school.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you had an option on? Or did
yeah,
they...
we were told to put down what we thought we could do, and I put administrative, medical, or communications. Well, I passed the test for communication. Three of us left from our barracks.
I would like your recollections. There was a bit of a window between the time you graduated from high school and the time the United States got involved in the war. What was pre-war at that time, in that window? What was pre-war Vermilion like?
Well, we're just waiting for the 147th to leave. Most of us knew all the fellas in the 147th. Some of my, let's see, 38. I graduated in 38. So there were some of the young men out of my senior class that left before 41 into the service. And we'd see them in uniform. And then when the boys went into service in 41, they were always coming home on leave. And there was always somebody wanting you to come to dinner. I knew all of the fellas because I worked at the bakery. And I wrote to almost all of them. I had about 8 letters a night I used to write to. And I don't remember too much about it. So much I had to forget.
When you got the dinner invitations, would you usually go?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I knew all the ladies, too.
Okay.
See, I knew everybody in town. That's why when I was in the service, going to school in Kansas City, somebody came to see me, and it was an officer. I'm not an officer. And we were warned that if we went with an officer, we would be fined $65. That's more than I made a month. And this officer came and told me he wanted to talk to me. He knew me. He knew my family. He knew even my dad's middle name. I was so dumb, I didn't know what he was doing. But I was hesitant. I didn't want to go with him. He wanted me to go out to dinner. I said, I don't know you. I thought I knew everybody in Vermilion. I used the chief of police and a sheriff for my references when I went in. So everybody knew me, and I knew everybody else. But that man, I did not know, and I wasn't going to go with him. But he talked me into going around the corner to a little coffee shop and having coffee with him. So I did, and he told me all the things. And I confirmed what he told me because he knew what he was talking about. Then he walked me back to the hotel. I lived in the Aladdin Hotel in Kansas City on the 13th floor in room 1314 with 3 other ladies. He was going to come right with me. I said, you can't go with me. He said, I guess I can. I said, no, you can't. And I'm the one getting in trouble. He said, I outrank your commanding officer. So I said, well, but you're not getting on that elevator with me. No, you wouldn't get on the elevator. Okay, fine. But I didn't. I wrote and asked who he was. I asked my folks. They didn't know. And it took me years to figure out that he was somebody sent to interview me for this War Department.
So never was from Vermilion?
No, he never was from Vermilion. He was some stranger sent out, knew all my whole record. A nice man, but I don't have any part of him.
Mm-hmm. So you're probably glad that you followed the procedure.
Mm-hmm. When I got this thing, oh, I knew what he was doing. They never told me I was in intelligence. Mm-hmm. I knew we had strict regulations to go under Flint Hill Farms. You had to have a pass to get in the first gate, then you had to have another pass to get in the other gate where the working place was. And our barracks was our camp was a from the air would be a plantation. The big barn was our where we worked. We had a silo where we stored our stuff, and then there was a big house where the captain lived, or the colonel, or whoever it was that was in charge of us. And then women were way down in a grove with four different barracks. We had our own mess hall and our own day room.
Where were you on December 7th of 41 when you found out that the Japanese had attacked?
I was home. And of course, it was all big news in the town. And of course, we worried Warren was, and Wayne, his brother, was in the 147th. Warren was not. He had, in 39, he joined the Navy. 19, he's 19. And he was in South Pacific.
So plenty to worry about right there.
Yeah, yeah. And Wayne was in this, most of my friends were in the 147th Field Artillery that I went to dances with and so forth. And they all just left right after December 7th. They called them up. So we were left. The girls were left at home.
Mm-hmm. How exactly did you find out that that the attack had taken place? Were you listening to the radio? Did someone come to the door?
Yeah, my dad was, he listened to the radio, yes. And so my dad went to work for the shipyards in Vanport City, Washington. And my brother went into the Navy, my oldest brother. I'm the oldest, younger brother. He went into the Navy. He was also a radio. My dad was a signalman in the First World War. My brother was a radioman on an LST. So it's in the family, I guess.
Okay. That's quite a record of service, and I know that's something that you certainly are proud of.
Oh, yes. My husband was in the submarine service and down in Philippine Islands. His boat was tied up at Cavite, and when Pearl Harbor was bombed, they knew what was coming. They were going to be next, and about 2 days later, I think it was, two or three days later, they bombed the boat next to the boat my husband was on, with a 500-pound bomb, and that's what I have in here. Warren used to tell it, but nobody would believe him here.
And do you have a letter or something, or a news article or something on that?
Yes. Okay. There's a magazine put out by the submarine veterans of World War II, and in there was this article, and it was exactly what my husband told us. And of course, it's written by somebody else because I couldn't get my husband to write anything. And that is exactly what Warren used to tell him. And of course, the men at the coffee shop would never believe anything he said because he'd get exaggerated.
Would you be willing to read a few paragraphs of this so I could just have this for our record in your own words, please?
Oh, please. Oh, you mean, why Warren had an earring?
Well, just five or six passages of that, if you'd like. Something that, if you'd like to jump at a point that you find particularly interesting.
Oh, and when the war was on, Warren was on the Sea Dragon, and part of the Asiatic fleet that was stationed in the Philippines. And in December 41, we were at a Cavite Navy yard for an overhaul. And on the same day Pearl Harbor was bombed, the Japanese wiped out all the airfields in the Philippines, thereby eliminating our air protection. On December 10th, 41, at 12 noon, the Navy yard was bombed. Three flights of 27, he said, 81 in all, flew over the Navy yard, dropping 500-pound bombs. We didn't have a gun that would touch them. They didn't even break formation. They completely destroyed the Navy Yard and all the ships in the dry dock. Our Sea Dragon submarine was tied up to the dock. Our sister ship, U.S. Sea Lion, took a 500-pound down the after torpedo room hatch, sinking her. At that very instant, one of our officers and I were in the conning tower. This is this man, and not my husband. He was in the engine room. The officer was killed there by the shrapnel he sustained, and while this man was rushing down the ladder to the control room, and another concussion knocked another 14 feet down to the control room deck, and there were some knobs about 2 inches long on the railing that used to be at the pump room hatch, and he fell into the one of the knobs sticking up, landing full force at the tip of his spine. And he lay down there senseless for a while, and then he heard a captain abandon ship. By the time he got picked up, picked himself up, and managed to get topside and was starting down the dock, the captain was then telling everyone to get back on board. And the salvage ship, the USS Wigeon, was tied up to their stern and had some effect in pulling them away from the sea line. And he said, we caught a lot of shrapnel. The pressure hull wasn't ruptured. He says a lot of the deck was gone. Part of the superstructure had holes in it, but they managed to get over to Manila, where they were subdued by the Canopus subtender. That's a subtender, USS Canopus. And then after 3 days' work, all night long, preparing them to be seaworthy, they left undercover darkness, went to lie down in the bottom of the Manila Bay until it got dark. He says that's the reason was because the Japanese waited till daylight to attack. And then when they were ready to go to sea on the 13th of December, they went to Surabaya, Java in the Netherlands, East Indies. And they passed Corregidor and started south, and they saw three Japanese destroyers patrolling the entrance to Manila Bay. The Corregidor is an army island fort on the entrance to Manila Bay. And then as they proceeded to dive, Japanese gave us a taste of our own depth charging. After about 2 hours, the three destroyers finally left and we surfaced. Then we went into Surabaya, Java. Went into Dutch dry dock and they fixed us up the best way they could. So they had a rough time.
Did your husband have any other close calls in his service?
Oh yeah, he said he spent time down in the bottom of the ocean when the young man was sick, and the corpsman operated on him for appendicitis. That's a movie. There's a movie on that. Mm-hmm. My husband wrote and told me he couldn't write about it, but he told me to read an article in a certain magazine. So I went and got it. I think it was the Esquire magazine. And I can't find it. I must have it someplace, but I couldn't find it. And there was a story was in there.
Now, you had to be very careful as far as letters and communication, not only to the soldiers, but from the soldiers back to you. Did you get a lot of mail
that was
censored?
I got a lot of mail that was censored, yes, I did. Particularly from, well, I worked at the farmer's elevator and got to know truck drivers that came in, boys that were picked up eventually into the service. And I worked at the bakery and I knew all the young men that I went to school with and my friends, brothers. And I wrote about 8 letters a night. And you know, I didn't keep any of those, but I did keep the one that came back missing in action. I never knew what happened to that young man.
That had to be very hard to get when you found out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, he was such a nice boy, young man. And of course, I wasn't immediate family or anything, so they weren't going to tell me what happened to him. But I always wondered what happened to him.
How did you meet your husband?
I've known my husband since we were wee babies.
And when did you realize that there was kind of a spark there?
Well, we were in the same group. We had group young men and women. I had a boyfriend that had been a friend of my dad and mother's boy for years. I think I went with him from the time I was 13 till I was 10 and 19, graduating high school, and he's still in high school. And then he ran away with the one girl that was dating my husband. they ran away because his folks didn't approve of her. So they left. He and his wife, they went to California. And then after Warren and I had been married and went to California, we met him and we were good friends again. Same, different partners.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've been to Morris's, well, a bunch of times since I've lived in town, and that's been over 10 years now. And I remember a newspaper article about brothers who
Yes,
found
the
each
brothers,
other.
yes, Warren and his brother found each other. Warren was stationed in Australia with his submarine. And he heard that the 147th was there. And he saw some on the street. So he went looking. And he got on a train and went back in someplace and found them. His brother and all his friends that were in the 147th, because Warren had been in the 147th before he went away.
They were quite handsome, if I remember the
Oh,
photos.
well, boy, they're both nice-looking boys. McWayne had red hair. I dated him for a while because he's a dancer and I love to dance. But Warren and I were closer, I think. It's not that we ever dated, but like if I was downtown and he was downtown, he'd say, "Let's go have an ice cream," and we'd go get the ice cream. That isn't a date, really, but we were close.
When you were in Virginia, I mean, Vermilion, South Dakota, and Virginia is pretty easy to tell the two apart, certainly. Was that a good experience? Did you enjoy living in a different part of the country? And did you make a
Yeah,
lot of
I
friends?
didn't know it was cold in Virginia because they unloaded us, the 100 that went to Virginia. First thing they said, "Is there anybody here that can knows how to make a fire in a coal stove?" South Dakota, Minnesota, and Colorado. We cut coal detail and we had to make fires in those four barracks and in the latrines where the hot water heater were. And we caught that duty till I blew up the stove.
Well, thank you, sir, for coming in and talking to us today. This is Homefront South Dakota, and this is Frank M. Marshall, also goes by Bud. Frank, could you give me your name, age, and hometown?
I'm 82 years of age, and my hometown is Vermilion, South Dakota.
Thank you for your service. What branch of the service were you in World War II?
U.S. Navy.
And what unit did you serve with?
We covered the South Pacific, 7th Fleet, mainly 7th Fleet.
Frank, where were you living during the war and how old were you at the time?
Well, up to 1943, when I enlisted in the Navy, my hometown was Walla Walla, Washington.
How'd you end up in South Dakota?
When the company I was working for at the time transferred me to Chicago, Illinois area, where actually we lived in Naperville, Illinois. We have three children, two daughters and a son, and our oldest girl was ready for college, and it was right at the time when there was a lot of radicalism on campus, and so we bought our daughter the college book, and she started with Illinois and kept branching out, and she finally came to USD, and USD had what she wanted, which was fine arts, and we came out, looked at the campus, and she applied and was accepted, subject to an interview, which we came back, and she passed the interview with flying colors. She ended up marrying a local boy. We have a second daughter who went to North Dakota State. When she graduated, she also married a local boy. And our son, he graduated from Washington State College in Pullman, Washington, and he ended up running my old company in Colorado. So how I ended up here in Vermilion, South Dakota was grandmother could go any direction and see grandchildren.
Okay, that makes sense. Tell me, for a kid living in Walla Walla, Washington, how much were you aware of the war before, say, Pearl Harbor?
No, I was not.
There was a lot of talk at the time whether America should get involved or not in the war. Did you have any opinion on that?
I can only say I was in high school, ROTC, and we certainly were cognizant of what was going on in Germany. We had no knowledge of what, of course, the Japanese were doing.
What do you remember about Pearl Harbor?
It was on the radio. We just found it hard to believe that something like that had happened. And it was about that time that I began thinking of enlisting in the Navy. I was a second lieutenant in ROTC, but I still wanted to go in the Navy.
How long after Pearl Harbor did you end up enlisting?
I enlisted in August or September of 1943. That's when I turned 18. That was as soon as I could enlist.
Tell me a little bit about going through basic training, and did you know where you would be headed after that, and where did you end up going? And
you don't know
that.
Where you're going. I went to a boot camp at Farragut, Idaho, as many others did. And when I completed that, I think it was about 2 months, I was assigned to radio school at University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho. Nobody asked me if I wanted to be. They just told you where you were going. And
people just accepted whatever they got, didn't they?
That's right.
So then where did you go from there?
After graduating from radio school, I was given, I think, 2 weeks vacation. And then I had to report to a staging center in California near San Francisco. In about a week and a half, I was put on a aircraft carrier for transportation purposes only, going to Pearl Harbor. At Pearl Harbor, I went into another barracks, and I think it was about a week and a half, maybe. I was given personnel papers from two or three men, plus myself, and we were driven to the dockside where the Anderson was tied up. I presented the paperwork to the officer of the day, and we became members of the USS Anderson ship.
What do you remember about that ship? What's the first thing you thought when you saw that ship?
I really was so confused by that time, I don't remember much. I do remember being assigned to a bunk in the fantail, or the aft section of the ship. Then I was taken up to the radio shack and asked to copy code. And for the sake of my life or whatever, I couldn't copy one sentence, one letter. I just froze. However, the next day I had recovered. I copied about 15 words per minute, which is not fast enough, but it was within just a few weeks I had my speed up to 21 words per minute, and that's what normally the proper speed that you have to be able to copy.
Okay. And this is, we're talking about Morse code here?
Yes.
Okay. And coming from where?
NPM. Radio Honolulu. Depending on where we were, we could copy NSS, which is Washington, D.C. And then we copied smaller stations like ADAC 2 in the Alaskan chain.
So where did you go from there?
Number one, you never know where you're going. You know, on the bridge is where they know where you're going. So we went to sea and we were convoying a troop transport ship. I don't know. We were out maybe 3 or 4 days, and one morning we woke up and the troop transport ship was signaling us with their signal light, who is convoying whom. During the night, our ship had somehow worked its way behind the troop transport, and there were a lot of red faces on the bridge. So we got in front of the troop transport and assumed our proper position. We then stopped at Funafuti, and only the officers were allowed to go ashore. And we left Funafuti almost immediately and got down into the Marshall chain of islands and so forth. By that time, we had lost the troop transport. They had been directed someplace else. And we continued on, going, I guess that it was southwest to New Guinea, the western part of New Guinea. And we operated out of that area for a number of months. By operating, I mean we went out, we shelled islands along with other ships. We transported when any of our outposts were in trouble. We were assigned to take Marines or soldiers out to help whichever our people were in trouble. We convoyed ships until we could sense there was something going on. And what it was is the Battle of Leyte Gulf in the Philippines, and which turned out to be the largest naval battle in the world. And my ship participated in that, but that's another story.
Okay, well, tell that story. Tell me about that battle, and tell me about what you guys did to support that.
Well, number one, for a few days we sat at anchor in the Gulf of Leyte Gulf, as did hundreds of other ships.
So what was that like, seeing all those ships there? Young kid, you know, kind of in unfamiliar circumstances, and to know something big is going to happen. What did you feel like during that time?
It didn't affect us, because we'd operated with ships before, and everyone was at anchor. You couldn't communicate with anyone, even if you had to. What did impress me was the Japanese used harassing tactics. They would fly between our ships, just above the water, and you could see their faces. They were that close to your ship, but you couldn't fire on them, because if you did, you'd hit your own ship on the other side. So, and they knew that, obviously. So they just had a nice morning's flight through the U.S. Navy.
So they were just kind of taunting you guys.
That is
what
correct.
What was everyone's reaction to that?
We got mad, but there was nothing we could do. They also had another harassing tactic, which was whenever we were ready to eat, they would fly overhead or again, between ships, enough that we had to go to general quarters, and they fouled up your meal. Whatever you were going to eat was cold by the time you could get back to it. But they did that at every meal, so you had to go to general quarters.
So then you guys are all prepared for this battle. You know something big is coming, and Japanese are taunting you guys. What happens next?
Well, if you were in the Navy, you sat on the deck and you watched them fighting on the shore, and it was our soldiers and Marines who were doing the fighting. Humorous situation. Three of our sailors was sitting on the deck facing the beach, and the beach, Hollandia, that bay was a huge bay. I've never seen a bay as large as that one was. So we would sit on the deck and watch the fighting going on ashore, until one day one of the sailors was sitting on the deck and facing the land, and a bullet hit the bulkhead right above him. And I guess he figured if they could get a bullet out that far, he better go to the other side of the ship, which he did, and we all did. But those are funny things, actually, that happen. You have to look at them as funny.
Sure.
And we did. But the Japanese were not sitting still. They put together, I think it was about three fleets, one coming down from Japan on the west side of the Philippines, and one coming up from the western section of the Philippines, and another fleet was coming down the east section, like could have been coming out of Tokyo or someplace up near Japan proper. Their maneuvering was great. Their courage lacked quite a bit, fortunately for us. Bull Halsey was an admiral. Well, he took on the fleet that was coming on the east side of the Philippines. What he didn't realize was that that fleet was set out there by the Japanese to draw us away from Leyte Gulf. Their planes didn't even have ammunition in them, or bombs, as I understand. Pearl Harbor figured it out, and they ordered Halsey to break off and return to Leyte Gulf, because these other two fleets were coming through the chain of islands, and we were short on firepower, and Halsey didn't pay any attention to us. He disobeyed orders, even from Nimitz. Finally, when it was almost too late, somebody hit him in the head and made him realize he was being very foolish. Two ships coming from the west part of the Philippines islands, the Navy, was to take on a battleship, several cruisers, and quite a few destroyers who were coming through a channel, and it was above the fleet that was south of them coming through a different channel, and our ship, another ship, and one or more destroyers were given the responsibility of stopping the Japanese fleet that was coming from the northern section. By that time, night had fallen. It was dark. One of our destroyers was told to stop the battleship if they possibly could. Well, they went out. They had each destroyer had 8 torpedo tubes, and they went out and they fired all of their torpedoes at the battleship and the cruisers, and everyone was firing at our ship, and they sank that destroyer of ours. My ship and the other destroyer, I think it was the Hughes DD-410, we were sent out to stop the Japanese fleet coming down. And we had enough fuel oil to get out, but we couldn't get back. We were that low on fuel oil. So they called us back. Apparently, we apprised them of the situation. And then the Japanese fleet kept coming, and we were sent out again.
With even less fuel.
Again, we were pulled back because the Japanese fleet turned around and went back. And that's the only thing that saved my ship and our sister ship. And we got back to the Hollandia Gulf, got fuel oil and diesel oil. By that time, the Japanese had changed their entire system and they were retreating.
So you must have thought that was almost a miracle that they turned around and left like that.
We didn't know what it was, but we were glad to see it. Then a couple of days later, my ship was sent to convoy some LCIs, landing craft infantry, down an inlet still in this huge bay, but there was a airfield down there, and the soldiers or Marines were to take it and put those planes out of commission. That inlet was a huge inlet, and on the left side was a mountain that it looked like it just went up. It was that steep and tall. And on this side, it was a low rolling mountain, and the airfield was over here. Well, this was supposed to have been a one-day trip for us, but we were just cruising around maybe 5 knots, just killing time and watching for enemy planes and whatnot. And all of a sudden, way in the distance were 3 Japanese, and I assumed that they were fighter planes. And they were minding their own business, but our gunnery officer decided that we should knock them down. Well, we opened fire on the ships. We may have knocked one down. He got over the small hill, and we don't know what happened to him. The second one, we think that he made it back to the airfield. He got behind that low mountain, and we couldn't see him. But the third one, we made him mad, and he came in from our fantail aft part of our ship. He had to have been out several miles, but he started in, and he kept coming, and he kept coming, and we kept firing shells, 5-inch, 40 millimeter, 80 millimeter, 20 millimeter, and we couldn't knock the plane down. Our gunners couldn't knock the plane down. And I had just come off watch, and actually, before we were out here, just 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 of us milling around, we like to listen to Tokyo Rose. And so I went inside and I turned Tokyo Rose on and piped her out. Mm-hmm. So we were standing right behind this superstructure. There's a deck in there, back in there. And then that's when we started firing at that airplane coming in. You couldn't tell where the airplane was going to crash. We knew he was going to crash, and I might have been the one, I just don't know. But we kept looking back and forth, this port side and starboard side, and finally, thinking of myself, I just took off going up the port side of the deck, and I wanted to get up to the front, and I knew the bullets couldn't go around the corner. So I started running up there, and I got about 3/4 of the way up, and a shell hit the deck about 3 feet off, and then I began to hug that hall. but I made it around to the front, and there was I must have been a gunner's mate coming from the starboard side, and he and I were both diving for the same spot, only he had on a metal cap, and I had nothing on my head. And we clashed, and I saw stars for a while. But when I brought myself to consciousness or whatever, I went back to the starboard side of the ship where the emergency radio was, shack, and that was my duty to be in that in case the regular radio shack up here was knocked out. Well, I never heard anything. There was no abandoned ship, nothing. So finally, I came out of the radio shack, emergency radio shack, and I decided I wanted to see what had happened. Well, I did, and I got up there, and I saw just blood and guts, all it was. They were all killed or wounded severely that they couldn't recover. And one of them was lying on his back. It had to have been the drive shaft from the airplane. The airplane hit the ship, it exploded and blew apart, and that drive shaft was bronze, about that long, and then it had your drive gear up here, which is about like that size, and it was protruding right through the center of one of these guys' chest. I mean, there was nothing I could do, and they were just a pile of bodies there. So I went back down, and I went to the emergency radio shack, and still had no direction, no message, no nothing, no abandoned ship. And what I didn't mention, all during the day, we had sharks going alongside the ship, big sharks. 10, 12 foot sharks. So again, got no direction, so I went up the starboard side again, and I got about this far, and there's a ladder here. And I started up the ladder and was just about going underneath the gun turret on the other side. Two guys went over the side of the ship out of that gun turret, and then coming down the deck was a man in khaki, and it had to be a chief petty officer or an officer, I never could determine which. Things were happening so fast. That guy jumps over the side of the ship right in front of me, and it took me about a half a second to decide what I was going to do. I'd rather stay aboard and go down with the ship than to go out there and play tag with those sharks. So I stayed aboard ship, which was the right decision. People began to get organized. We had one officer who was up on the second level there with the hose, and he was putting out the fire up there, and he already got it out down here. I didn't realize it, but the plane had stuck to our ship, and while I was in the radio shack, some of the guys pushed the ship off the deck, and it sank. And for months, I didn't realize it. They had done that. Anyway, I think we lost in total about 16 or 18 men. We began organized using our radio shack. Well, all of the radio shack was burned out pretty much, and all of that area was burned out. We didn't have anything to do, so I was sent up the mast to check our antennas up here, and they were all right, so I went back down.
So the ship didn't sink.
The ship did not sink.
And you guys
and
gathered.
We did what we could do. Both boilers were knocked out, and the Black Gang, we called them, were working on those. The tide waters kept moving our ship toward that ultra steep bank, and there's nothing we could do. And it was sometime during the night, and another radio operator, Bernie Klingshern was his name, and I, nobody wanted to go below decks. So we were trying to sleep on the decks, and it wasn't feasible. We heard a rumor that the Jap pilot had been blown into the laundry area, and we were going to go and see if it was. And of course, you can't have any lights on, so we went around there, and Bernie went in first in the compartment, and he found an arm, and I was reaching to get a hold of the arm while he worked on the rest of the body, when out here we heard a large splash, and it could only have been a torpedo. About that same time, then the Jap plane went over our ship, and fortunately, he came down the side where that mountain was about that steep, and the beach was maybe 40 feet wide, and that torpedo went down, scraped the keel of our ship, and went on. Well, I tell you, I figured it out one time. I came close to death 5 times that night. The torpedo didn't explode. I didn't get hit by the plane or the plane's bullets. I can't remember now the other, but there were about 5 times that I could have been killed.
Whatever became of the ship
okay.
And what happened to all
that? That's another story. The black gang got one boiler working, so we had enough to limp back to the Gulf. By that time, they had gotten the second boiler working. We didn't have a lot of our gear, but we had a radio or two working. I think they had the radar going. So they gave us the job of convoying a cruiser that had been hit by a torpedo, presumably going to take it back to Pearl Harbor. Sometime during the night, we had an emergency message by radio that there was a Mars plane, one of the big, huge planes that can land on water, was down, and we were the closest ship to it. So we were sent to see what we could do for them, and we found them right away. There were two of those planes. One was circling, and the other one was on the water. And the pilot in the plane that was circling set off a magnesium flare in the middle of the ocean with Japanese subs all over the place. And our captain, and I wouldn't repeat what our captain said, but that's the last flare that plane ever dropped. To be honest, I never found out, or I never even tried to find out what happened to the plane that was down. Well, one thing I did hear at the convention we just had, they wanted us to put a rope onto the airplane and drag it to someplace. We made it back to Pearl Harbor, and fortunately, they could not handle our repair job, and they sent us on to San Francisco. Oh, that was hard duty.
So what kind of feeling was that when you found out you were on your way to San Francisco, that was good. Your next stop?
That was a good feeling.
I bet. Especially cheating death like that, the way that...
Everybody got to go home. And
so what would you say were the high points and the low points of your life during the war?
Well, the low point was when I was running up the deck, we had a young man who was a striker. A striker means he's studying to be a radio operator, what this meant. He was just one of those nice people, and he was right beside me, and he got killed, and I didn't. That was, I think, the low point. I had to write his wife. He was a family man. He was a young man. That was difficult for me to do. You would think the high point would be when they announced that Japan had surrendered, but it wasn't, and I can't tell you why it wasn't. I think some of us just didn't believe it. We did believe it when we started going into the Japanese ports, going ashore. Then I believed that they had given up because we could go ashore, not fear of being shot.
Do you think that the war changed you?
Oh, certainly.
In what way?
It's something that you will never forget as long as you live. You wake up sometimes at night reviewing what happened. Why did it happen? Could you have done anything? I wake up occasionally copying code, as stupid as that sounds. And I can still remember code since 1944 or 45.
Tell me about your family back home during the war. Did you communicate with them?
Yes.
And how?
But you can't write anything about what you're doing or where you are. I learned that very quickly.
So you just avoid those topics and...
Yeah.
And sure.
And you really have very little to that you can talk about.
Why is it so important that people remember World War II and remember what happened in World War II?
Well, that's what concerns me, that in some schools they are not even mentioning World War II. And that upsets me, that we have people in the United States who want to downplay and people who blame the United States for it, which I don't believe we did. Everybody was responsible. I would like to see a course taught in high school by a non-liberal teacher who would tell it the way it was, because I am proud of what I did. And I think we've got a bunch of liberals in this country now who I wish would go to Siberia and stay there.
Well, very good. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about your experience?
Well, some of the funny things that happened.
Yeah.
In New Guinea, we were anchored in the cove, and they would let us go ashore for a couple hours, and they gave you two cans of beer. Well, I didn't drink in those days, so I'd go ashore, and I guess Army personnel were building roads, and it was pretty muddy and whatnot, and I would trade my beer for seashells. Soldiers, they liked the beer very much. Mm-hmm. And one day, I happened to see one of our fighter planes in the weeds. There was no way it could take off, and it must have run out of gas or something. And they landed on that partial road, and then they went off and into just right by the side of the road, but in those weeds. Well, not having anything else to do, I tried to look in the cockpit, but it was so high up there I couldn't. So I started, you know, you try to jump up and see in the cockpit or grab a hold of the edge of the cockpit, and I couldn't even do that. So I thought, well, maybe I could go get on one of the wings. So I started to turn around, and I look down, and I'm standing on a rack of bombs from that plane. I learned how to walk on glass very gently, and I got away from there. In New Guinea and in some of those places where they still had natives, the natives had these outriggers, you know, with two poles going out and a balancing pole out here, and the hull is here. And they would come out to our ship and want food. We'd hold up a nickel, then we'd hold up a dime, and we'd barter for something. Well, they'd take the nickel first, because that was the bigger one. And they didn't realize the dime was silver in those days. Mm-hmm. One time, one of the guys aboard ship had false teeth. This guy takes his false teeth out of his mouth, and he goes like that at him. And the last thing we saw that night was one of those natives paddling with one arm and trying to pull his teeth out with the with the other.
Well, thank you so much.